This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Hello and welcome to The Feed with Amber Mack.
And Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On the show, we share how social media companies are responding in the wake of real-time tragedies.
Plus, why Netflix is drawing a line in the sand when it comes to employees quitting shows.
Also on the show, the latest on Elon Musk's Twitter deal and the future of bots.
And we dive into how one organization plans to save Jane Goodall's decades of research.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
Trending up.
Well, Amber, another week, another bunch of headlines. It just doesn't seem to end. But before we get started, I think people are starting to get out and about. It's a little bit warmer where you are.
Yeah, it certainly is. Yes. Yeah, so it's springtime. Things feel like they're definitely returning to normal or a new normal, whatever you want to call it. And you see more happening on the streets and more energy around. I've done a lot of in-person events as well as lots of virtual ones. So it's been a busy spring so far. And Michael, I know you have been pretty much around the world. Let's be fair.
Yes. If I sound a little tired, it was a very last minute trip to Australia. So if I have a little bit of a delay, it's because I'm back in Australia. But before that, yes, I was in Vietnam and Singapore working. And then unfortunately, my mom got sick. So I am down helping my dad and doing some family stuff. But, it's a positive. I get to see the family again, even under these circumstances. But we do have a lot to get to in the show. So, Amber, what are people talking about?
So you're right. We have a bunch of different headlines to get through over the past week. And we're going to start with what's happening at some of the social media companies, in particular, Facebook and Twitter. So according to TechCrunch, what we're seeing both on this site as well as other tech news sites is that many of these tech giants are having trouble really containing some of the footage that has come out from the recent tragic Buffalo shooting that took place. This was a racist attack that took place in New York State, and 10 people were murdered. It's really a devastating story. And the 18-year-old who is the shooter, he actually live streamed his attack on Twitch. This is a gaming streaming platform, if you're not familiar with it. And Twitch did remove the video after a couple of minutes as the violence began. But of course, there's a lot of that video content that has really made its way throughout the web. And I guess the question is, Michael, is that how hard is it really for these tech companies to stay on top of this? And what responsibility do they have?
Well, they're great questions. And unfortunately, straight after this shooting, the actual shooter's stream was quite easily available, it seems, on Twitter and Facebook and some of those other social media platforms. And they did try their very best as quickly as possible to take down as many videos as possible. But unfortunately, you could do things like jump on Twitter and you know, it suggested searches like Buffalo video, full video graphic, and Buffalo video leaked, and those kinds of searches, and bring up those videos. A lot of people obviously flagged the video content through the mechanisms that are on these platforms to try and take down inappropriate content. And so that happened. But the problem people had was how long it took. So sometimes up to 3 hours afterwards, you could still find video of the horrific shooting. And I think that's the problem too. So people are still unsure of, is it that there, it's just such a large platform, it's so difficult to do it in real time or as close to real time as possible. You know, it takes a long time, and that's the problem. It's already too late and it's already spread. So I don't think this is going to be an easy fix. And I think we've been talking about this for, you know, many years now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's definitely not an easy fix, but you know, obviously, this is another example of how social media companies need to invest in both people and technology to be able to mitigate the harm that this does. So we will keep an eye on this story. Another story we wanted to talk about is all about Netflix. And this is an interesting one. They've basically told their employees that if the employees want to quit because they don't like content that they're working on or they don't agree with that content, they can just go ahead and quit. So threatening to leave because you don't like the show that you're working on at Netflix isn't necessarily going to help you anymore. Netflix has really put their foot down.
Yeah, and they have done it in a very solid way, I guess, is the way to put it, because they actually said this in their new points under their cultural mission, I guess, for the company. And basically, as you just said, they are telling their employees that they need to be prepared to work on content they may not agree with. If you take away just from Netflix and content, I think that's in a lot of jobs. There are lots of parts of jobs people do that they don't necessarily like, that they might have to do, or they might not necessarily agree with. This one's an interesting one because, content can be subjective. I mean, there are some content made by streaming services that, that make people uncomfortable. It is interesting the line they're following. It's like, if you don't like it, you can quit. I guess they kind of don't want people picketing all of the time. So, I mean, because that's very disruptive to the workplace as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting just to see the evolution of kind of the rules of engagement when it comes to just how far you can go as an employee in terms of kind of pushing your beliefs and what happens when the company kind of pushes back. So I don't think these things are bad things. I think they're sort of a natural evolution in terms of employers listening to employees, and it'll be interesting to see this one roll out. Now, we, of course,
speaking of rules of engagement.
Yeah, we want to always keep up to date with the story. And by the time you hear this, it probably has changed once again. But Elon Musk has basically given Twitter an ultimatum to say that he does not plan to move forward with the $44 billion takeover of Twitter until the company can prove that less than 5% of its users are fake or spam accounts. I mean, the concern here is that Elon Musk is concerned that the account is even higher than that, and he would basically be buying a platform with a bunch of bots. But you know what? I could have told him that for $1.
But so this is the thing. It's like, I thought the whole idea behind him taking over this platform was to fix it. But I don't know. I kind of read this as, oh no, but you have to tell me, it's not as much of a problem that I need to fix as it was made out to, or I don't know. This just seemed such a weird kind of proviso to go through with the deal when he seemed all gung-ho and all in at the start.
Yep. That pretty much sums it up. All right. So we will stay on top of this story because it is constantly evolving.
Alrighty, when we return, how artificial intelligence is helping to protect Jane Goodall's legacy.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Techstar.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. The Jane Goodall Institute has selected Media Valet to securely archive and manage more than 60 years of historic and present-day scientific research and conservation digital assets for the organization. They are leveraging the latest in artificial intelligence, and we are so excited to see the plans to preserve the legacy of Jane Goodall's work. To talk more about this is David McLaren, who is founder and CEO of Media Valet. Hi, David. Thanks for being on the show.
Hello, Amber Mack. Hello, Michael B.
You are doing some pretty incredible work here, and we are so excited just to hear more about how this came to be. So can you talk a little bit about what you're planning to do and how this landed in your lap, so to speak?
Sure. So Jane Goodall Institute, the institute that was created many years ago to help preserve Jane's legacy, contacted us a couple of years ago, and they were really starting to lean into this idea of preserving and extending her legacy for future generations. As the majority of her research since 1960, when she stepped foot in Ngombe National Park, has been observational research, where it's taking notes, taking photos and video, and just recording what she's seen with the chimpanzees. And then over time, as more and more researchers joined her, the amount of research data and photos and notes and video started to grow to today, there's hundreds of terabytes of research assets. So they wanted to aggregate all those assets into one central, highly secure library. And they chose the cloud and approached us to do this, to bring all those silos across multiple universities, multiple offices, research centers, and camps, bring all those assets into one place, the historical assets, and then assets going forward into that central media library, and then back it up to make sure that it's secure for future generations. It can't be deleted or misplaced mistakenly. And then after that, they wanted to see if they could use artificial intelligence to help make the assets more discoverable so that scientists today and tomorrow will be able to easily access and find assets relative to their research at that time. So they approached us to do that. They first approached Microsoft looking for a partner, and Microsoft recommended that they reach out to us. So after that introduction, we very quickly started exploring the AI component, because for us, bringing hundreds or thousands of terabytes of assets into a central library is pretty standard. It's what we do every day. But this idea of applying AI to the researchers, so Jane herself, as well as the other researchers, so facial recognition, that's relatively standard. Going back 60 years, some of the assets can get pretty grainy. So there's a nice challenge there for us to dig into. But the more exciting challenge was applying facial recognition to the chimpanzees themselves, so they can be recognized in past decades, let alone currently, and be able to tie all that research together. So from camera trap footage, which is the motion activated cameras that are in trees and in the ground, as well as all the photos and handheld video, tying all that in to all the written notes and that have been taken over the 6+ decades that they've been researching chimpanzees in over across like 10 camps throughout Africa.
So for those people listening, what does that mean for researchers and the way research is done today if you are able to capture all of this past research and apply this artificial intelligence and apply this facial recognition technology to animals like chimpanzees that have been part of her work? What does that mean to the research itself? Like how does that improve, I guess, the way they interact with the data and use the research?
A really simple example would be, remember decades ago when we all had Encyclopedia Britannica in our homes? Think of them all being different, and on those would be research caches of information compared today to Google. Now, that's what we're doing. We're effectively allowing people to search from their computer all the research that both Jane and her team have created over 60 plus years. But think of a video right now that could have multiple researchers in it, maybe a couple of chimpanzees in it, in a specific camp in Ngombe National Park from 1968. And there's some really interesting findings in that research in that video clip. Today, unless a researcher remembered that it was there, they wouldn't be able to find it. Using AI, we've identified the chimpanzees, we've identified the researchers and Jane, all using facial recognition. We've also used artificial intelligence to take all the spoken word in that video and identify that. And then all the notes that were taken, whether they're in Swahili or in English or in German or Spanish, whichever researcher was taking the notes, those have been digitized, and we've used OCR, object character recognition technology, to identify the written word, even if it's handwritten. And then we can take all of that and associate to a specific keyword search that's been created.
What does it mean to you to be part of this? Because her legacy is significant.
So for me, I grew up with Jane as a bit of an idol, and just following what she was doing in her research when I was in school. So to be contacted by the Jane Goodall Institute, and then later on have a chance to talk with Jane herself, and to be able to be part of the organization that is securing all that research for future generations, it's pretty crazy. It's a little surreal, to be honest.
Well, before we let you go, having a front seat to all of her amazing work, what's been the most rewarding or the most interesting find from doing this work?
I think Jane herself. She's an amazing lady with a tremendous amount of experience that then gets translated and transferred to you through extremely compelling stories that helps you, I don't know, really take account into where you are in your life today relative to the environment and the world, like the earth itself and the other inhabitants of it. It just makes you think about that and how you're connected. And I leave every discussion just thinking what I can do more to help the Institute, help Jane, and help our planet.
Well, listen, we wanted to thank you so much for joining us. We are so excited to watch this project, and thanks so much for being on the feed.
It's been a pleasure.
Up next, stay with us. We talk about the latest smart thermostat from Ecobee.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Apptastic.
This week's Apptastic segment is powered by Ecobee, each their best thermostats yet, with a beautiful new design inside and out. The all-new Smart Thermostat Premium and Smart Thermostat Enhanced include a refreshed user interface and Ecobee's most advanced sensor technology to date with radar. Plus, Smart Thermostat Premium is the only smart thermostat with both an indoor air quality monitor and a smart speaker with your choice of Alexa or Siri, all encased in a stunning metal body. If you're looking to save up to 26% on your annual heating and cooling costs, head on over to Ecobee's website to invest in your comfort, home health, and security needs. Ecobee's products are built to last in your home, not in a landfill, and the software is upgradable, so you'll get the newest features and updates on their latest devices. All right, Michael. Okay, so we are going to talk about apps, and we have three good apps. And I want to mention, too, I talked about Ecobee. They also have an app for their smart thermostats, which is really, really simple to use. And speaking of useful things, we have three awesome apps that you have stumbled across. And the first one is called Capsule.
Yeah, so Capsule is exactly what you think it's going to be, and it's all about saving and capturing your memories. Now, of course, we are on a lot of social media platforms, scattered, if you will, across many social media platforms, and there's a lot of content, there's a lot of stories and photos and memories that we're sharing across those social media platforms. And so this app actually helps you capture all of your material.
Very cool. I like that idea. And I think she, it reminds me a little bit of, I know obviously we don't all have the legacy that Jane Goodall has, but I appreciate this idea that you want to be able to have sort of digital footprints of your life. And there is the opportunity for that history and legacy to live on through digital means. So this is a nice tie-in to what we were talking about a little bit before as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So you in each of the capsules, and this is my understanding of the app, you can save no more, you don't have to. So this is the problem. So whenever you take and do social media, you take tons of photos and then you try and find just the one that you like. So with the capsule, you can put as many things as you like into this capsule, save it all, and then it's basically forever. And you can sort through it whenever you like and come back to it and revisit it. I would like it too, to be fair, in the olden days when we would print out photos and put them in photo albums. And then we would have those photo albums. So it's kind of similar to that, but a digital version.
Very cool. Okay, so sticking with the theme of digital, next up we have a social detox tool. It's called Gatekeeper. And the idea is that essentially you can kind of put a gatekeeper on your phone so that you have a social detox. So the idea is that this allows you to have some separation from social media when you need a break and you need to kind of step away a little bit. And what's funny about this is the app lets you create a new password, which is only shown to you during your non-detox time. So
isn't that genius?
Yeah. So it's basically just a way that you would essentially not be able to get into some of your social accounts when you, you've locked yourself out, essentially. So again, as far as I understand, it doesn't mean you're changing your Facebook account, your Instagram account. It's just access to it through your mobile device. So just want to be clear, we're not recommending that you change your password every 5 minutes, but it does allow you to have that separation or that break that I think a lot of people are interested in. It's pretty cool. I'm going to read a little bit about the instructions, Michael, but what about this idea that do you think people need to step away from social?
Oh, 100%. So, and it's quite interesting because not to get all macabre, but a couple of friends in my life have going through some very serious, very scary things with their kids, health-wise, myself with my mom. And I have noticed being in hospitals and recently, the people are not on their phones, which I thought was very interesting. And they're actually interacting with their family and friends and loved ones around them. And it made me start to think when I'm back in like my everyday life, how much we rely on the phone and how little we pay attention to the people around us in properly. And so I do think that it's quite a problem, especially with young people as well. And so I think something like this can be great because even we think we all have self-control, but I think this just helps a little. So when you plan an exercise during the day, when you put time aside to do activities, I think it's important to also put time aside not to do social media. And so this is just a nice little tool that helps you remember that. And gives that password and forces you during a certain amount of time in the day where you probably shouldn't be on social media and just try to curb how much time we spend on it because it can be a great tool, but it can also be very unhealthy as well.
Absolutely. I just read a little bit further about it. So I think in some cases they do actually make you change the root password, but I just encourage everybody to do your own research to see how it works. And, again, it just is encouraging you to really step away from social media when you get a chance, which like Michael said, I think for everybody, it's always a good idea just to take little breaks as well. Now on the flip side of that, we also have done and, I'm obsessed with my list. You know, if I feel overwhelmed in the morning, I always get up and I make a list and I just start crossing things off because what else can you do, right? When you have a lot to do. And I do that in paper form right now. So I have a notebook that allows me to kind of prioritize the things that I really need to get done and work my way down that list. And it is incredibly helpful in terms of just managing your productivity and not
sure, but it's the feeling, right? But it's when you cross that an item off the list, the sense of it, just the gratification is immense, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, and also I think it's necessary because sometimes, and I do this too. I mean, even now where I feel I'm pretty productive throughout the day, there are days where I feel so overwhelmed, like I'm never going to dig myself out of this kind of work grind that I'm in. And then I'll write down four or five things. And I'm like, it's ridiculous. Like these things do not take long to do. It feels like a lot, you know, when it's kind of floating out there in the world. But when you actually put it to paper and you realize like, this is going to take 10 minutes, this is going to take 5 minutes, you know, maybe got to make a phone call. This is 3 minutes, whatever it might be. So anyway, to get to the digital part of this, Tick is a to-do list and a task maker app that, I love awards, Michael. So they've won a bunch of awards. Great to-do list app for new Android devices from The Verge. And this is always good. I always encourage people to read the awards and reviews when they're trying out new apps. So they have really good ratings, like 4.6 out of 5. And that's from almost 100,000 people.
Yeah. And so it's a really easy and intuitive design. You can personalize features and it does all the things that you would expect from a to-do list app. So as Amber mentioned, you can can track your habits, work to accomplish stuff, personal goals to achieve, basically anything you need to do, shopping lists that you can actually share with the family if you need a little help. So it's all in one there. So those three apps, again, we've got Capsule to keep all your memories together in one place, the Gatekeeper social detox tool app to help curb the amount of time you spend on social media, and of course, to get your to-dos done, TickTick is a great app for that as well. Of course, if you've got an app, gadget, or product you think we should check out, tweet us at AmberMac and at MBancroft80. And of course, use the hashtag TheFeed. Coming up, we talk about the future of work at Airbnb.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167. Techstar.
All right. So for our Techstar in this segment, the person I want to put up there in the spotlight is Brian Chesky, who you've probably heard of. He is, of course, the CEO of Airbnb. And in the tech community, we do hear enough about him, but I don't think he has such a big profile as maybe some of the other big names out there like Musk and Zuckerberg, and the list of those goes on and on. But most recently, what he announced at Airbnb is that there are big changes over there in terms of how people are able to work. We've probably talked about this on the show in terms of the future of work, but what he's saying is essentially that all of their employees, and there are about 6,000 of them, have the ability more or less to relocate to any city they want to. They will get paid the same. He's not going to micromanage them. He sort of believes in this idea of flexibility and freedom. He thinks it will make them more productive. And as I mentioned, we've talked about this in the past, but what was really interesting is that he recently did a Washington Post interview, Michael, where he talked a lot about a new way of working, and he's making headlines because he is basically saying that the way that we have been working is dated and I would also say not effective. And he just believes that during the pandemic that they saw a future that definitely wasn't built around the office.
Yeah, there's a couple of things here too, because obviously I think it makes a lot of sense for a company like Airbnb, because obviously they are a company that is wanting people to travel all over the world, experience new places in a different way. So obviously Airbnb, for those people who have never used it, you know, it's people's homes that are opened up to other people to rent for short periods of time or long periods of time, or it can be an investment property, it can be a room in your house, it can be all different kinds of combinations. So I think that it makes sense from a company mission perspective. I also like the fact that this isn't just talk. And so what I mean by that is that he's actually working with about 20 countries to remove some of the red tape around securing a temporary work visa. And so all of the things that prevent us from being able to work wherever we like in the world, you know, there are a lot of barriers to do that. So obviously it's very different if it's simply, let's just say you're in Canada and you live in Toronto and you would like to live in Calgary or PEI or something. It's a little bit different. You can do that if your employer is okay with that, and you can do that remotely. There's no visas involved or anything like that. But he's taking it one step further and actually saying, you know what, I'm okay with it no matter which country you want to work from, and I'll even try and help you do that. And I think that is really interesting.
It is interesting. And I think one of the reasons I think this is so fascinating is that there are times when employers do this, Michael, but then they go and say, well, you're not going to have the same salary or benefits that you would if you lived in maybe an urban area near one of the offices. But I think what Brian Chesky is trying to do is to really say that, you know, that's irrelevant in terms of the way that he sees the future of work. And the second thing is, what I think is fascinating, if you look at this article, is that he talks a little bit about the fact that He thinks that the office of today will be totally unrecognizable. These are his words in the future. He also says that, you know, he thinks that these office buildings will be eventually converted into residential real estate. And it will be, if there are offices at all, they will be totally different spaces that are built around this idea of connecting and collaborating versus kind of the stale cubicle style offices that we've seen in the past.
Yeah, and I think that also is, again, in alignment with his company. So if you look at companies similar to Airbnb when it comes to office spaces, you know, there's WeWork and many others. And it's that idea of sharing and that environment that you're speaking of. And you only go in and out of there when you need to meet people and do those face-to-face things, but you don't want the overheads of having, you know, a permanent office there that kind of sits idle for a lot of the time, especially if you can have people that can do a lot of their work from home. And, you know, it does get into the debate, which obviously you hear from all sides, you know, how productive are people at home, and when they're not being micromanaged, or not just micromanaged, but, you know, when they're not, they're not with their team, and they're not, you know, having those meetings with their managers and things like that. So I think the way in which we, if this is going to be successful, the processes are going to change as well. It is interesting when it comes to the monetary side of things, because there's that argument, if you live in a more expensive area or a city, then you should be getting paid more and those kinds of things. This is, again, very interesting that, well, it's putting the power of the decision of where you live on the employee. And so giving that ability, you can work from anywhere, that's your choice. So if you choose to live in a very expensive city, you know, but your job and your salary and the expectations of what you do are still going to be the same, and you're going to be paid a fair salary. But obviously those, you know, those other things that usually get taken into account won't be.
Yeah. And he talks a little bit, although I would love to hear more about this from him. He talks about the technologies that are needed for the future of work. And I really appreciate his comments about how we need better camera technology. I think, and we've probably talked about this on the show, or else I keep thinking we should, is that I think about Zoom and these platforms, they've gotten us through the past couple of years, Michael, but they're not the best technologies, and they're certainly not the sort of end of the road in terms of video conferencing. There's a long way we can go in terms of realistic video, better sound, better immersive experiences. So I think that's kind of fascinating when we think about the future of work, the role that technology will play to allow us to work more effectively. And I think it's not going to be kind of, you know, grainy video on Zoom.
Yeah. Or I go back to just always think, when you are having a meeting, do you actually need it to be video? And I think that's the thing I have out of the pandemic, because Amber, you and I have always worked remotely for many, many years. So it wasn't anything new for us, but it was interesting and fascinating actually to see people kind of freak out, and the amount of work and time they put into being on camera, or and not really thinking, do you need to be on camera? Do we need to have a 20-minute conference? Can this be done in 3 to 5 minutes on an audio? So those kinds of things, I think we need to retrain our brains. You know, I think that the overarching problem that no one knows the answer to is, you know, being remote, will we still build meaningful connections? And I think that kind of comes to the crux of everything. Whether we have the right technologies, whether we have the right policies in place, will we still have the same connections as we do face to face? And I believe we won't. But I don't think people care as much. I think they prefer that flexibility over those connections. I could be wrong.
No, I think it's a really good point. And I think that everybody's going to kind of have a preference, right? And that's part of the challenge as a leader, is to say, hey, now it's not just like come to the office and everybody comes 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and I don't have to think about it. We have to kind of cater and personalize the experience for everyone. So certainly an interesting evolution, I think. And I think we're still, again, really in early days.
We certainly are. Well, stay with us. Everything you need to know about the future of UFOs.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the spotlight.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Now, the U.S. Congress held its first open briefing on UFOs in more than 50 years. And here to discuss is investigative filmmaker Jeremy Corbell. Now, it is a pleasure to talk to you. Now, I guess the first question really is, why is this such a monumentous occasion? Why is this so important, and why are people so excited that this actually happened?
Right. It's a very important question. It's because in over 50 years, we have not had transparency about the UFO phenomenon, the UFO presence on planet Earth. There are machines, whether you believe it or not, it's not a matter of belief. It's either true or it's not true. And you've done been told it's true. There are machines that outpace, outmaneuver, and outperform our greatest weaponry around the world that fly within our restricted airspace with absolute impunity. And they demonstrate a technology, a propulsion technology that our government has said in the US, we don't have. They also said, we don't know whose it is, who made these machines, where they come from, what the intent is. And no other technologically advanced nation on planet Earth that we know of have these. So what was once science fiction, it's now science fact. So why these are so important now is because finally, we are coming from a data-rich perspective, not a data-poor perspective. Our government is openly saying, okay, it's real. UFOs are real. We know they're machines. We need to know more. And representative government represented us. They're asking questions. That's why this was so monumental, finally, after 50 years, to have these congressional hearings.
What do you think was the tipping point for this to happen?
Well, I can tell you for sure, it looks like a tipping point from the outside. This has been a slow grind for people like me. I held mock congressional hearings in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club in 2014 with my friend Ruben Langdon. We had five congressmen, one senator sit and listen to testimony. This has been a long road. Remember, the United States government said we stopped studying UFOs in 1969, nothing to go on. However, it was then revealed by the New York Times in 2017 that there has been a secret UFO government program underway. Well, guess what? They actually got it wrong. New York Times got it wrong. The real name of the secret US government UFO program was AWSAP. Now, it's a big word, Advanced Aerospace Weapons Systems Application Program, but they studied UFOs for 27 months, and they determined that these things are not from here. So the tipping point is really in the court of public opinion. All of a sudden, UFO Twitter, people started calling their congressmen, their senators. It just became this thing where Congress is like, wow, we need to deal with this. Oh, wow, the military has been hiding this? And that's precisely what we realized in these briefings.
I'm more concerned of the fact that there's flight apparatuses out there that could get us cheaper and easier to Mars than wasting all this money from, like, say, Elon Musk. Or am I thinking too simplistically?
No, that's a great point in a lot of ways. You know, we're spending money on things that maybe other people have figured out. But here's the deal. The bigger issue, there's two. So one is national security for every country on this earth. Now, it's not that there's hostile actions, but we do know that UFOs have been able to turn on and off our nuclear weapons, that they perform. They swarmed 10 of our Navy warships in 2019 off the coast of California. And I actually obtained from sources and released that Pentagon confirmed military filmed corroborative video evidence. So here's the deal. The big concern, you're thinking right, but the big concern is this. Who made these? Where do they come from? What is their intent? And then the bigger idea here, this is existential. Are we part of a larger fabric of this universe that we have been unaware of? If life is prolific out throughout the homogeneous universe, are they visiting here? And this has been going on since the beginning of recorded human history. So you are right. But also, we have to think about national security, and we also have to think about the existential value of knowing that we are part of a larger ecosystem. And that will change the way humanity looks at our life on this little blue dot that we call planet Earth.
I'm curious if you think that people are just sort of not coming to terms with UFOs being real because it's maybe a hard pill to swallow, just like we see, you know, the climate crisis being something that people most likely believe is real, but they don't necessarily know what to do. And I see sort of this reaction from the public where oftentimes they're not sure what to do with information. So I guess I'm asking you the question, like, what do we do now that we know this?
So cognitive dissidence, you know, let's say we have religious views that exclude the idea of, you know, other beings, that can be a cognitive dissidence that stops people. Really, it's the boiling point, right? It's the frog in the pot of water kind of situation, kind of like you're saying with climate change. When we don't see it hard and fast and sharp right in front of our eyes, we kind of acclimate to it differently. But what we're seeing now is that hard and sharp and fast acknowledgement that UFOs are real. It's not a matter of belief. They are machines from somewhere else. We don't know where somewhere else is. It could be a society that's been here longer than us that we just don't know about. Every option is on the table at this point. What we do know now, though, is that life will change for us. Our children growing up in this new reality, a new reality that includes the truth about the UFO presence on planet Earth. And look, don't take my word for it. A lot of your listeners, maybe they haven't heard about it. They just haven't been paying attention. And don't be 4 cents short on a nickel. I mean, educate yourself. Look at what's being said. The whole point of this congressional hearing was to reduce stigma. Why would they say that's the point? The point is, secrecy can serve as an obstacle to solving the UFO mystery, to understanding it. Overclassification and secrecy. We need to reduce the stigma 1 degree at a time, just like climate change, which you mentioned, right? We need to bring people up to date, up to par, so they can understand what's going on, how we react. Well, first of all, don't panic. This is not a radio broadcast like War of the Worlds. UFO has been around a long time, right? So the idea is, let's look at this scientifically. Let's rationally and soberly look at what does it mean? Where are they from? Who are they?
So I think that's the question. So just before we let you go, what does it mean now? So we've got this knowledge, we've got this confirmation, if you will.
Yes.
What's next? Does this mean that we should expect governments like the US to be spending more money on finding those answers?
Don't worry about the governments of the world. You are the cartographer. You are mapping out this new reality that we live in the moment, even on social media. That's where I drop all of my new government-filmed leaked videos, leaked to me, that I obtain and release. It is happening in real time. This is one of the greatest mysteries of humankind. And we are now at a point where we can start to engage it. I mean, look, you can tell I'm excited. I'm so thrilled. Mount Everest got nothing on me. I'm on top of the world. But what I need people to know is that they can engage this, they can become proactive, they can learn about it. They can see government film videos that are sent to me on my social media. I mean, it's pretty incredible times when journalists like me can get information out instantaneously.
Very cool. Well, listen, we just want to thank you so much for joining us, Jeremy. And we want to encourage everybody to follow you on social media. I've been doing the same over the past few minutes. So again, it's at Jeremy Corbell. And thank you so much. I think people can check you out online as well at extraordinarybeliefs.com. Is that correct?
That is Jeremy Corbell. Everything, I'm too easy to find. Thank you so much for covering this important topic. You will realize that it is more and more important as you cover it. So stay in it, get in the game, get your hands dirty, start looking into this. You'd be amazed what's going on right now all around you.
Very cool. Well, thank you again for joining us and staying on top of this story as well.
Thank you so much.
Up next, what we think of Twitter's new misinformation policy.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Socially Speaking.
It's time for Socially Speaking, and we are going to talk about Twitter this time around. Twitter just recently introduced a new misinformation policy. Well, I should say it's a new crisis misinformation policy, as if misinformation wasn't already a crisis. Now it actually is. And you can see a blog post from Twitter that they have shared online. So this is a global policy that they're implementing to help to really, as they say, guide their efforts to elevate credible, authoritative information and ensure that viral misinformation isn't amplified or recommended during a crisis. Now, there's a bunch of things that they're doing here, guys. So hopefully you've had a chance to check out the blog post. And one of the things that's getting some attention is that Twitter will hide, according to TechCrunch, false tweets from high-profile accounts during times of crisis. So they're sounding more and more like an editorial organization, and the content organizations that they claim they are not. They're no longer just a platform. Michael, maybe I'll start with you on this news. It kind of makes sense, but I'm sure there's going to be lots of backlash for them kind of tweaking what goes out there.
I wonder if you can undo policies you put into place, because this sounds more like they're preempting something that could happen in the future. And what I mean by that something, I'm not being elusive, but I mean Donald Trump or Elon Musk, or like, that's what this sounds like to me. This is almost like it sounds like they're preempting what could happen because they've already experienced it from high-profile users tweeting out certain information that may not be true during times that are exceptionally important. That was my gut feeling. And I do find it interesting that they're putting out policies like this when they're also trying to force, I saw a headline that they want to force Elon Musk to go through with his deal. So I know I keep bringing back Elon Musk into this, but this does seem fueled by that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also fueled by anyone who is verified, who has the ability to potentially encourage millions of people to believe something that is untrue. So, Aaron, I know you spend a good amount of time on Twitter. What do you think just at first look at this policy where they're focusing on misinformation in a crisis?
I think it's a noble intent, but I think it's riddled with holes. It's more holes in this than Swiss cheese, which I love to eat at times. I see this differently. I differ from Michael's opinion. I don't see this as targeting one person with lots of power, like a Donald Trump or Donald Trump type, or a president or prime minister. I see this as targeting, there are unfortunately, you know, thousands of armed conflicts happening around the world at any given time, and every person involved in every armed conflict around the world has a smartphone and a camera and a phone and access to the internet. And I see this as trying to curtail half-truths or misinformation that are filmed on the ground in armed conflicts that may not have the entire scope of the story or the conflict, and then a half-truth or half-story gets blown out of proportion and retweeted into oblivion. That's what I see has already happened in real life, in the real world we live in. I see them trying to curtail this in the future, but there's human bias in everything. It says here in the link you sent out, Twitter will require verifications from credible public sources, including conflict monitoring groups. Conflict monitoring groups have bias. Humanitarian organizations. There's certain humanitarian organizations which serve one region and not another. That's bias. Open source investigators. Who are the open source investigators? Journalists. Journalists have bias. Journalistic organizations have bias. Journalists only get hired by the organizations that share their bias. And the people at Twitter contacting those people have their own biases when they look at the tweets themselves. So if there's an armed conflict, if there are two sides in conflict, if all the people down this chain fall on one side of bias, pro one side or against the other, then something untrue or half true could get blown out of proportion anyways and slip through the cracks of this process, slip through the holes in the Swiss cheese.
Wow.
Well, so Amber, and I do understand what you're saying, Aaron, but I think that remembering that Twitter had begun working on their crisis misinformation framework last year, and there has to be some point at which you draw the line in the sand, regardless on if we just assume everybody has some kind of bias in some framework. And so I believe this came about because of what we saw with COVID-19 and the spread of misinformation. So, you know, there was a pandemic. They needed a vaccine. That was the best way to curb it. Those are facts. There's no beliefs. Whereas, you know, so information that spread, you know, to the contrary, that's the kind of information that they're trying to stop, especially in this example that I just gave, when it's public health emergencies.
I think it's one of those things where if they don't do anything, they will get attacked. And if they do something, they will get attacked. So I can't help but wonder in this situation, if some of these platforms maybe start to call themselves something different. And what I mean by that, Michael and Aaron, and maybe Aaron, I'll throw the last point to you, is that maybe we've been sort of misled by the term platform as if, you know, they don't have responsibility for the content on there. I think we've learned that they truly do. So Twitter came out and said, hey, you know, we're a progressive social site that allows people to engage. And there was clearly some type of editorial team that did some mitigating of content that could be harmful. Would that make things any better? I mean, gosh, I don't know if that's a good idea, but Aaron, you get my point, right?
I do. I'm trying to think of a convenient phrase, but you can call something something else, but it's still the something that it is. I know there's a funnier, folksier phrase about this, I don't think it matters what they call themselves. It just matters what happens and how the content is monitored. And I think these days of free flow of information, of unmonitored content, and the pie-in-the-sky dreams that Elon Musk sometimes says he has for completely unmonitored content, those days are done. And I don't care if they call themselves a news organization or a platform or a social media platform or connecting individuals or whatever. It's the information is out there, and I don't know. It's like you said, they're damned if they do and damned if they don't, or darned, if you will.
I think the blue check mark, you know, the verification, although I think there are good intentions to it, I think that also doesn't help, because all of a sudden they verified people and people think, okay, well, this must be a legitimate source of information, and that causes some problems. So maybe we strip away the check marks. I don't know what the answer is, but please do let us know, because we are always looking for your feedback. You can find us online at Amber Mac and at mBancroft 80. And Aaron, where can people find you on the Twitters?
I am on Twitter at my name, Aaron Papernick. That's Aaron with one A. Send me pictures of your Swiss cheese.
And please use the hashtag The Feed.
This is The Feed with Amber Mac and Michael B on SiriusXM Canada Talks Channel 167.